You've had a dynamic where money's become freer than free.
If you talk about a Fed just gone nuts, all the central banks going nuts.
So it's all acting like safe haven.
I believe that in a world where central bankers are tripping over themselves to devalue their currency, Bitcoin wins. In the world of fiat currencies, Bitcoin is the victor.
I mean, that's part of the bull case for Bitcoin.
If you're not paying attention, you probably should be.
Rick and Seth, welcome to the show. First time, long time.
Yeah, thanks for having us on.
Yeah, I'm excited for this. I've been, man, Tales from the Crypt was the first show when I first went down the rabbit hole of Bitcoin and fell down the listen to 1,000 hours of podcasts. Tales from the Crypt was the goat for me. So it's really, really cool to be able to be on here. Obviously, I've known Adele for a really long time, but we've never gotten to chat much, Marty. So I'm excited for this. Thanks for having us on.
I am as well. I mean, you guys just launched Radar Chat this week, which is a long time coming. Adele and I have been talking about the need for Bitcoin payments and Signal for years. I think since we started Rabbit Hole Recap 8 years ago, it's always been a topic of discussion here and there. You guys have finally launched it. Thank you for that, number one. And number two, I think the juxtaposition of your launch date on July 7th and everything going on in the EU as it pertains to chat control, VPN banning being talked about in the UK, of facial recognition being talked about in cars throughout the European Union. And it seems like the digital panopticon is being erected around us, and it's incumbent upon us in the freedom tech space to build the tools to route around that. And it looks like with Radar, you've done just that. So I think to jump off, just talking about what convinced you to build Radar in the first place, and why now?
So, I mean, there was a lot of factors involved. One being, of course, the community wanted it. You've talked about it, Odell, like you said. Even Jack Dorsey's tweeted about it. And we have a pretty good video coming out on that pretty soon. So that was a big driving force. Another one was on my trips to China, you know, everyone using WeChat. And when it comes time to pay at the cafe or wherever I am, you're not pulling out another payment app or anything. You just use the same app that you're communicating with. So that was also a driving factor. You know, right now for messaging, it's so natural. Everybody's doing it all the time. That's what you wake up and you do. You check your messages, see what you've, any messages from your friends or family. So it's already a platform that everybody's using all the time. And there's already so much stuff flowing in the messaging apps, like text, of course, but also video, pictures, documents. So why not money, right? That's what we thought. Why not money? Why can't Bitcoin flow through this, the same system? And why now? I think the tech is there now to do it. I don't know if you know, a couple of years ago when Seth just joined on, actually, we were trying to implement Lightning into Cake Wallet, and it was just a terrible user experience. Even though the user didn't have to worry about managing channels and liquidity and all that, still the user experience was pretty bad. And actually Seth killed that when he came on, so you can blame him. But then, you know, Spark and Breeze built an SDK for Spark. And we put that in Cake earlier this year, and it was a huge success. And we're like, okay, this is it. This technology is here now. We can put it into Signal. Then your next question should be, why Signal, right? And we kicked around the idea of doing another messaging app, you know, a new one altogether. But I mean, you probably have 4 or 5 messaging apps on your phone right now, at least. And now try to get people to download yet another messaging app and have all their friends and family join. It's a heavy lift, right? Signal made sense. They're gold standard in privacy. It's open source. We can build on it. They have some payment rails that we were able to take advantage of with that mobile coin. They did. So yeah, with all these things coming together at the right time, it was an obvious and right time to do this project.
Seth, you've been on the tip of the spear of freedom tech, and particularly as it pertains to bringing privacy to users, like how would you describe the implementation of Radar leveraging sort of Signal, that open source project, and then the way in which you guys implemented Bitcoin payments within the wallet?
Yeah, for sure. So, I mean, I think Vic covered all the high level details. The biggest things to me are, one, like you said, like the ability to do Lightning in a way that feels frictionless, but is still self-custodial. I know we can maybe get into some of the specifics of the trust model of Spark down the line if you want, but in my eyes, still self-custodial. That just really changed the game. Because even if you look back at the Bitcoin for Signal campaign that happened a year, 18 months ago now, there was a big push on X, Jack Dorsey and others pushing for Signal to add Bitcoin in directly. That push was using Cashew, which is a custodial eCash solution, which is great for privacy, like essentially perfect privacy on the transaction layer, but requires a custodian to actually hold people's Bitcoin. And obviously one problem with that is, like, obviously we want people doing self-custody. The other problem is Signal themselves as an org, if they actually touched custody of anyone's coins from a regulatory perspective, that's a complete shift for them. It makes them a huge target. So they weren't going to want to do that. But honestly, when that campaign went, even in these last 12 or 18 months, there's been a revolution in the payments UX that's possible with Bitcoin while still letting people actually hold their own keys. So Spark was part of that. I've been really leading the way. Arc, through both Arcade and Bark, are getting there as well and allowing us to build tools like this where suddenly we don't need to have the user like understand the ins and outs of Bitcoin or deal with a ton of headaches or figure out what does inbound liquidity mean or how do I buy inbound liquidity and how much do I need and what happens to it. Like, all of that stuff goes away and people get to just make payments simply. So it's really that the technology for building around Bitcoin actually has gotten good enough that we can put it in apps where people aren't necessarily ideologues. Like, people are using Signal today who have no clue what privacy is provided. And that was another reason why that was such a good pairing for us is Signal have hit that sweet spot over the years. And it's a sweet spot that I think many of us in the freedom tech space are targeting of how do we build underlying, incredibly impressive privacy tooling, but on top of it, build a user experience that is just very, very approachable, easy to use, and that people want to use, even if they don't care about the underlying privacy. And even when you look at Signal, like I have gotten all of my friends and family to get into the Signal network over the years. I have not convinced any of them of the need for broader personal privacy. I don't know if that says a lot about them or a lot about me as a poor evangelist, but I haven't been able to convince them about the broader need. They don't have any idea how Signal itself works under the hood for privacy, but they're just there for the good features. And they're there because I'm there and other people that they love are there. And I think that's where we need to get Bitcoin to over the long term is people just use Bitcoin because it's the simplest, best tool for the job, not because necessarily they're ideologically motivated to use Bitcoin or because they embrace Bitcoin maximalism or any of this, but rather they just, hey, I'm already chatting with these people. Oh, I can also send value. Like, I can pay them back for lunch. I can send a remittance over borders without having to worry about anything, without having to worry about custody, without having to worry about if it will be intercepted in the middle. It opens up a whole new world. And now it does it in a way that combines the people you're already chatting with. You don't have to start from scratch with money that is cross-border, that is permissionless. And that's the real powerful combination. And a lot of it is that the tech behind it has gotten good enough that we can do that in a way where it's honestly just seamless.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned like Bitcoin's. Oops. Sorry, Vic.
Sorry. I was just going to add to that. Just a broader, I guess something that's going to happen, trend that's going to happen is people are going to stop building tools for Bitcoin and force people to join that tool, but rather embed Bitcoin into existing tools and risk. Like Jack Dorsey did with, am I frozen? Am I going in and out? Oh, okay. I froze there for a second. Like Jack Dorsey did with the Square terminal, you know, it was already a existing infrastructure and he put Bitcoin Lightning in there. And the same thing we did in an existing messaging app and we put Bitcoin in there. So I think that'll be the trend moving forward. Rather than making things for just Bitcoiners, make things for regular folks and put Bitcoin in there.
Yeah. I mean, I think. diving deeper into this, more technical details, or maybe like the philosophy of the tech, like why Signal versus something like WhatsApp for the layman out there? Like why Signal the way in which you described it compared to something like WhatsApp, Telegram, other messaging apps, and then Bitcoin, obviously with the rise of the agentic economy, the X402 protocol and the OUSD consortium bringing stable coins. Like why not embed a stable coin in the app? Why start with Bitcoin? What, considering the use case that you're going after, which is private speech and sovereign money, like why aren't those other tools good for either speech or money, or maybe not optimal for the use case that you're going for specifically?
Yeah, I guess I could give a basic reason and Seth can get into more of the technicalities. Signal made sense because it's open source. There's no corporation behind it. It's an organization and a nonprofit organization. But the main thing that it's open source, and we could fork that right away. And it's the, like I said, it's a gold standard privacy. Like Seth said, it's a gold standard privacy that makes privacy easy. You don't even know you're being private. And Bitcoin Lightning made sense. It's fast, instant. You can do very, very small payments. Stable coins, I mean, I think that's something we're considering in the future, either giving users a choice to automatically convert to stable coins so they don't see their value fluctuating like you may with Bitcoin. It would be a great feature for non-Bitcoiners where they open up the app and they just see a USD balance. They don't have to worry about, they don't even have to know that it's Bitcoin Lightning in the back. So we're kicking those ideas around. I guess from a more technical reason why we chose Signal, Seth could get into that, why we chose Bitcoin Lightning.
Yeah, I mean, the pairing is very intentional because I think something that we, like, I know y'all have been talking about for a long time on the show, Marty and Odell's been beating the drum on, is like the stuff needs to be freedom tech. It needs to be something that enables the individual. And so the underlying messaging tool that we use had to be something that was censorship resistant, privacy preserving. Other apps claim that. WhatsApp, Telegram famously claim that all the time about that they're a privacy messenger, but they're not. They're not at all. They kind of use that as a marketing veneer, something to put on what they're actually building, but it's not core to what they're doing. And even when they do it, there are a ton of drawbacks and caveats to the actual privacy preserved or to who has access to those chats. Even if they aren't encrypted, WhatsApp, for instance, those chats can easily be sent as well to Facebook and they get access to all the chats. So they're end-to-end encrypted in many scenarios where they are accessible by third parties. So Signal, yeah, I mean, it's the standard for privacy preserving messaging. So we wanted a really good base to go with there. Also, messaging protocols are very complex and you can go wrong in many different ways. And so being able to use what is the gold standard of messaging protocols out of the box was also a huge win for us. So we didn't have to reinvent the wheel there. There are some other messengers that are doing really cool things with reinventing the wheel in terms of messaging protocols. Simplex, for instance, have done a great job there. But we wanted to lean into something that was very established and set in stone on the messenger side. And then obviously like why Bitcoin, like it's the same reasons. We want freedom tech to be paired with freedom money. We want it to be that we want the bones, the rails, at least to be Bitcoin, no matter what. So like, even when we talk about exploring stable coins in the future, those would only be stable coins that live on Bitcoin. So like specifically we're using Spark under the hood, those would be stable coins on Spark. So yes, in theory, those stable coins have different trust models. Like some of them can be frozen, not necessarily all of them, but some of them can be frozen remotely, even if you have your own keys. So obviously they're not filling the same freedom money space, but when we're talking about people who just want to be able to send remittances back to South America, maybe they don't want to deal with the volatility of Bitcoin. So I think giving users that choice, but doing it in a way that is still, they hold the keys to that, still lives on the Bitcoin rails. And the very important piece to me is it gives them the add a tap in a second ability to swap between those stable coins and Bitcoin and get to permissionless money very quickly. So I think something we're going to see with stable coins is it's all fun and games until your Tether gets frozen, your stable coins get frozen. And as people experience that more and more, as the pain of that comes more and more, we'll see that people want to shift to hard money, to something that is more censorship resistant. So enabling that rail to be able to switch at a tap from your stable coins to Bitcoin when you need a kind of a flight to safety, that's really critical to us as well.
Yeah. I mean, another sort of topic I really want to dive down, because Vic, I know you and I have been talking about this a lot, which is the emergence of vibe coding. And I had Francis Pollat from Bullet Bitcoin on earlier this week. Like, they sued the French government for an infringement on privacy rights of their customers via the DAC 8 legislation or regulations that went live earlier this year, and that Bull Bitcoin's expected to report on early next year. And like I said earlier, it seems like the attack on privacy, the attack on individual sovereignty in the digital age is being waged at an accelerating pace. But it also seems like the ability to combat that with the building out of freedom tech tools is encouraging, I would say. And I think I'm very curious to get your thoughts on historically the knock on freedom, or not the knock, like the lack of adoption of freedom tech has been because of the convenience factor. It's not as convenient as the closed sourced sort of walled garden tech that makes everything easy out of the box. And do you think with the emergence of vibe coding, or just the maturation of the freedom tech protocols and the development sort of concentration around these protocols, that we do have the ability to compete with the closed sourced platforms and technologies that really make the trade-off of convenience or privacy in favor of convenience? So your lack of privacy, but you get way more convenient experiences. Do you think we're getting the feature parity and UX parity in the freedom and privacy space?
So I think the genie's out of the bottle, right? I'm one of those people that believe that the will of the people does win out in the end. Governments, regulators can keep fighting something, but the people want it and do it. And you saw that happen with Bitcoin, right? In the early days, you remember in 2012, 13, there's so much FUD that was going to get banned. The government's going to crack down. And eventually it got so big that they couldn't ignore it. That, you know, these people are trading value in billions. And regulators finally looked at it. Governments finally looked at it and said, hey, okay, we need to somehow bring this into the fold. As far as freedom tech is concerned, I think it goes along the same line. You can't dock code. If I publish some code somewhere, take KQuality, for example, right? It's open source. We can go away tomorrow. Governments can shut us down, let's say. But you can download the code and you can build it yourself. And I think your vibe coding references is really applicable here. Because before, you know, 3 years ago, if somebody gives you a code, hey, you can download KQuality and build it yourself. Like, well, I don't know how to do that. I'm not a developer. I'm not a coder. But now with AI, you can just feed that into Claude or ChatGPT, and boom, it'll make you an app. And the UX UI reference you made, I mean, Elon Musk last year tweeted out, because of AI, user interface is dead. And he's right, because on the fly, you can have it look whatever the way you want it to look. You can take the cake code and say, here, build me a wallet, but make it look completely different. Do something that you like. So now you can do very custom user experience the way you want it. Hide information you don't want, show information you want, features that you want, features that you don't want. You can control everything. A side note, does that worry me about cake? Well, yes, it does. But but I think in the long term, not thinking selfishly, thinking selflessly, I think in the long term, this is all going to contribute to freedom tech and the use of freedom tech and accessibility to freedom tech to the regular folks. So I think all these efforts by the EU and things is futile.
Yeah, I think it like vibe coding also enhances the overall uplift that comes with open source code. Because one of the really nice things about open source code is, like, for us as a business, we can't compete on an intellectual property moat. Like you mentioned at CakeWallet, like you can go download the code right now, the exact code that we're publishing to all of our users, and you can go build it and you can go customize it in whatever way you want. Not going to necessarily recommend like vibe coding complex changes to a wallet that's self-custodial, because obviously there are risks there, but you can do that today. And so what it means is that us as a company, we have to compete very aggressively for users by building what they want. We can't just sit back and say like, okay, we built something, it's locked behind IP laws. We're just going to do the bare minimum and keep it alive and just keep people locked in with a subscription for a decade. Like that world is dead. That world used to exist. That world is dead now. And that's a really good thing, because it means that the actual end tools that get in people's hands are much more competitive and are much more built for them. I think the other thing, like Vic touched on this with UI UX on the design side, one of the really exciting things about vibe coding is not just the backend code side, which I think is what most people think about when they think about vibe coding, but actually AI is really good and getting much better on the design side if you know what you want and if you have a good idea in terms of brand, that sort of thing. Like a good example of that is the website for Radar, radar.chat. I built that, but it was built from a really good brand that Jaime, our head of brand, came up with, good logos, color palettes, all of that. So like it still needed good underlying building blocks with good messaging system that was built by folks at Neural Radar, helped us out on the marketing side. But then I was able to build a really beautiful website. I'm not a designer or a developer, but I knew what I wanted and I had good building blocks. And the ability to do that is something that I think has been a problem in the freedom tech space for a long time, where usually it's very technical people who have a vision for what the technology needs to be, but have a hard time translating that into a beautiful user-friendly product. But there's really good tooling now on the AI side in terms of design review, in terms of the actual like building the websites and the front end side of things as well, that can let us build freedom tech that's really beautiful, intuitive and approachable and easy to use at the same time, which is a big shift as well in the space.
What's up, freaks? This episode is brought to you by Block's Bitcoin ecosystem. You probably know Cash App. You probably know Square. You definitely know BitKey if you've been listening to the show for the last couple of years. What matters most is that these are not disconnected random products. They are part of a broader push to make Bitcoin easier to buy, easier to hold, and easier to use in the real world. Cash App helps people stack Bitcoin. BitKey helps people custody without turning self-custody into a weekend engineering product. Square helps merchants run their businesses and increasingly plug into the Bitcoin native payments rails. Listen, this is the kind of ecosystem Bitcoin needs. We've been talking about this on the show for a while. We know that we need the different parts to line up to make Bitcoin everyday money. Block is doing just that. Check the episode description for the current Cash App, BitKey, and Square links.
So, freaks, when you take Bitcoin seriously, you start with custody. You want to control your keys, avoid single points of failure, and make sure your savings cannot disappear because you or someone else screwed up. That is what Unchained has been focused on since 2016. Unchained is the leader in collaborative multi-sig custody and Bitcoin financial services that keep you in control. They secure over $12 billion in Bitcoin for more than 12,000 clients. That means about one out of every 200 Bitcoin sits inside an Unchained vault. Their model is simple. You hold two keys, they hold one key. And it always takes two keys to move Bitcoin, meaning their single key can't access your Bitcoin on its own. Just resilient, shared custody that gives you institutional-grade security while keeping you sovereign. Unchained also lets you trade straight from your vault, access Bitcoin-backed commercial loans, open a Bitcoin IRA where you hold your own keys, and set up personal, business, trust, or retirement vaults. They even offer inheritance solutions built for long-term hodlers. Or opt for the highest level private client service with Unchained Signature and get a dedicated account manager, discounted trading fees, exclusive access to events and features, and much, much more. If you want a partner that helps you secure and grow your Bitcoin without giving up control, go to unchained.com and use the code TFTC10 at checkout to get 10% off your new Bitcoin multisig vault. That's TFTC10 at unchained.com.
I said, speaking of shifts, let's shift back to Radar specifically, because I think it would be remiss for us not to dive into some of the details. One of the most important to me is the fact it's completely interoperable with Signal right now. And that I think that for you guys is massive, like the ability to back up your signal key and your encrypted key and then upload it into Radar and then have your chats there in the Radar app is a massive 3UX boon, because the thought of downloading a fork of Signal and trying to rebuild your contact list and reach out to people to start new chats is a bit cumbersome. So I think the ability to basically onboard yourself on the Radar and have it in a way where it's like, oh, it's just picking up all your Signal chat history that you're using as an everyday driver makes that sort of adoption hurdle much smoother. It's not even a hurdle. It makes that adoption curve much smoother.
Yeah. I mean, like Seth and I have been using Radar as our primary Signal client for 4 months now. And right, I message you on there. You can't tell I'm using another app or anything. It works seamlessly. And like I said earlier, that's what we wanted. We wanted to enter something that's already there, not try to bring people onto a whole new thing and learn something completely new. So I'm glad to hear that's being accepted well. Although we did think it was obvious that people should back up their Signal first and then restore from backup. We're adding a little splash page to the next update, which will warn people, hey, before you move any further, go do this on Signal first. Your Signal will stop working. Of course, you can link it on another device like your desktop. You can still run Signal on your desktop or another phone if you have it as a linked device, but not as a primary device if you want to use the Bitcoin features of Radar. But yeah, that like you pointed out, that was important for us to bring it to something that already exists rather than making something brand new.
And to really drive it home to people, I mean, just for those who are listening or unaware, like how big is Signal? How many users do they have? And how many potential users?
Over 100 million, yeah.
Yeah.
100 million, I think.
Yeah, like 100, 150 million monthly active users, just for clarity on the specifics of the number. Obviously way more than that in terms of downloads and potential users, but monthly active somewhere between 100 and 150 million. So huge, huge audience and one that is growing very rapidly.
Yeah. Well, I mean, well, Seth, your use case, you mentioned with your family, you don't realize the privacy tab, but you have to imagine a large portion of that user base is in it for the tech, for the privacy, because they realize the benefits of it. And was that part of the intent too? Is like slowly sort of orange pill Signal users or the Signal Foundation itself?
It would be a win.
Yeah, I think they want to stick to messaging though. I don't know. I haven't spoken to anyone there, but you know, they do messaging well. They do privacy well.
Yeah, I mean, like we talked about a little bit too, like the vision here is not that this is just for hardcore Bitcoiners who already know about Bitcoin, already use it. It's not just to be another wallet app. Like there's plenty of wallet apps out there right now, honestly. Like that's not what was needed here. So a huge part of this too is like Signal users already have clearly a desire to move outside of the existing system in terms of messaging, but the vast majority of them are not Bitcoiners, I would guess. There's definitely some crossover. It's hard to obviously estimate exactly what that crossover is, but Signal is heavily used within at least all the Bitcoin circles that I'm in. So there is a good crossover there. But there's also a lot of users, like we talked about, who are just there because of the network effect, there because of maybe the privacy. Like it's starting to become a little bit like that. It's becoming a normal thing that people understand is like, if you want a private conversation, it happens in Signal. Actually, that was funny the other day on just a sports podcast that I listened to. They mentioned that maybe they should start a Signal chat for their private conversations because they shouldn't have it in SMS anymore or something. It's becoming something that's become just kind of a cultural norm of if you have something private, you do it in Signal. But it's also just a draw to people because it's a really good cross-platform messenger as well. So the goal is far beyond just the hardcore Bitcoiners. Like obviously not that we don't want hardcore Bitcoiners like that. I think they'll be the first adopters, definitely the tier one audience here. But the reason we've made it so honestly, like stupid simple to use is because we want it to be something that anyone who's familiar with any other payments app can do this. You don't have to understand Bitcoin. You don't even have to necessarily back up your seed phrase. Like you can manually back it up and we prompt you to do that when you first receive funds, but we're able to back up your seed phrase directly and encrypted into your Signal profile. So that when you log into, if you lose your old phone, you log into a new device, all your sats come with you. You don't have to do anything for that. You don't have to remember that you had a separate seed phrase. It automatically comes back up without any issues. And that's the real impetus here behind all the decisions we're making is we're not going to add additional complexity that you would have in a like a fully featured Bitcoin wallet. We're not going to add a ton of bells and whistles. It's very much meant to be how simply can we show people how powerful Bitcoin is as a payment rail, as a value transfer system, and really start to bring back that peer-to-peer digital cash method of exchange side of Bitcoin and make that something that people are doing and get it snowballing so that people who are not even Bitcoiners are using it because of how simple it is. And that's where I think the real value will be down the line.
What, in your mind, would make this a success? What are you looking for? What expectations do you have for this out of the gate? And what would make you guys extremely happy to see in terms of user interactions with Radar?
I mean, in terms of users, who knows? I had to throw a number on it. I don't know, 10% of what Signal has. I think if we get even 10% of what they have, they're on 10 million users, which would be fantastic. I mean, just for comparison, Cake has 2 million users, but Cake is a cryptocurrency wallet. That's what it is. It does nothing else. It's a cryptocurrency. You're a crypto person, you want a wallet, and you download that. But Radar isn't about that. So I think we can exceed the user base in terms of numbers compared to Cake Wallet. I think that would be a huge success. And I think, as we talked earlier, I think we would have to kind of shift away from Bitcoin and do a stablecoin type of thing to try to get those to get to those numbers. By the way, I missed one of the factors. You asked me what were one of the factors that led us to making Radar. Another weird factor was, and you know this already, and you've heard this, people say, hey, Vic, why don't you make a Bitcoin-only wallet, right? Cake is great, but I'm not going to touch it. A lot of Bitcoin maxis say that, right? So this is also kind of our way to put a Bitcoin-only wallet out there. So that was kind of interesting. But yeah, I think if we just in terms of pure numbers, I think if we can get 10% of Signal, in my mind, that would be a huge success. And who knows after that, if people continue to see the value in decentralized instant transfer of value, which is what Bitcoin is meant to be, then that number could go whatever from there.
Yeah, I think an interesting outcome too would be obviously we've not been able to reach Signal, but it'd be interesting to see what their thoughts are about this long term too. Like, will they want to integrate Bitcoin as a result of this? Like, will they want to add some functionality like this? We'll see long term what that looks like. But I think this could also be just a huge proving ground for the desire and demand for Bitcoin support in messengers overall, and can show how this can compete on a user experience perspective with the custodial bank fiat centralized options that are the norm right now in the Alipay, in the all of the other payment systems that are in messengers today that are on the just regular fiat banking rails.
Yeah. And I'm thinking back to your comments earlier about being in China, Vic, and pulling out WeChat or Alipay, whatever it may be. Like, your chat app is your payment mechanism. And I mean, China is an example of, I think, how to do it wrong at scale. And it's interesting that this type of technology,
correct, but the surveillance is wrong.
Yes. And it's funny that we haven't really had a WeChat like app hit critical mass in the US yet, which is probably a good thing considering Facebook. I mean, Facebook, I think, probably tried to do it with Libra before they shelved that. Yeah. But really honing in on like the potential to create a WeChat or Alipay like super app in the United States for a global audience that is privacy preserving is extremely encouraging.
And yeah, I mean, I see this as
we're. Sorry. Go ahead.
No, I think WeChat, I see this as a open source, private messaging, decentralized payment, this version of WeChat, if that makes sense. It's doing the same thing. You can message and you can send value, but you're doing it in a private and decentralized and self-custodial way.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, Seth, while I have you here, I think you're very eloquent in describing this for everybody listening who may be one of the, I have nothing to hide. So I'm going to make the convenience trade off. Why is privacy important? And why should people care about it, especially today?
Yeah, I mean, the underlying reasons, I'm sure most people have heard at this point. But the interesting thing to me is this, like, I have nothing to hide kind of pithy statement that's become the normal retort. I think that sentiment is kind of dead. I don't think that's really how people feel anymore. And I think there's been a concerted shift, especially over the last 5-6 years, for people to understand, after finally seeing all of the problems that come with a lack of privacy, that people are starting to understand, like, this does actually matter. And I think the sentiment now is much more, what are the tools? Like, are there actually tools that I can use that aren't too painful to gain privacy? And that's been the huge gap there. I think, like, Signal is a great example of that, where a good privacy tool needs to feel as easy to use as one that is not privacy preserving. Like, we have to care about the user experience here. And so for the core of, like, why does this matter? Ultimately, the things that you do, the people you message and the people you pay, tell everything about you. If I can see who you're talking to, even if I can't see the message contents themselves, and if I can see who you're paying when, I can pretty much figure out everything else about your life. And no matter what other things you care about or what other rights you think are being protected, if you don't have the ability to protect your conversations and your transactions, your actual financial history, everything else falls apart very quickly. And so that's the huge impetus here, is like, we can solve both of those at the same time. Signal already solved the messaging side. Let's latch onto that and make the most of the already existing protocol network that's there. And then let's bring the financial side of that home at the same time. But again, I think that the critical thing for people is not, I don't care about privacy, especially when you talk about financial privacy, like, no one is going to ever give you their bank record or their credit card statement or anything like that. They would never publish that online. Like, they do. There's a natural innate desire for privacy, especially financial privacy, but privacy more generally. And when we can actually do that in a way that feels like I'm not sacrificing too much from a convenience perspective, that's the huge breakthrough for people. I think that's why we've seen Signal be so successful when it comes to messengers. I think that's why we've seen Proton be so successful with their suite of tools that they offer, is that they get very close to the same user experience of the centralized surveilled tools, but they also give you strong privacy. And that's what people want. I mean, you even look at Apple and others, their marketing campaigns are heavily focused on privacy these days. That's not just because they feel like they might want to care about privacy. It's because people are actually seriously considering, which thing will I buy? Which tool will I use, based on if it does give them some level of privacy at the end of the day?
Yeah, I think Apple's been, I don't know if it's Apple of report or reports of Apple talking about, like, having many models on the iPhone using the secure enclave. I think that's another thing, like the emergence of AI, and particularly the frontier models, with the leaders being Anthropic and OpenAI. Funnily enough, Alex Karp from Palantir, I think, made a pretty eloquent point highlighting the privacy trade-offs that a lot of enterprise clients of these frontier model providers are making, in terms of giving up all your IP. And it's funny that this AI revolution may force people who previously did not care, or at least do not appear to care that much about privacy, it may force them to, as they're thinking about how they share their data with these frontier model providers.
Yeah, absolutely. That's one of the other really cool things about, like, as the technology gets better, we can actually do powerful things in a privacy preserving way much better at the same time. I mean, that's even, like, when we're talking about, like, how we're able to do Bitcoin within Radar, like, that wasn't possible 2 years ago. And that's not necessarily because of hardware changes, but that's because people figured out new good ways to be able to do things in a self-custodial manner. That shift has come to AI as well. And that's where, like, everything is also faster when you're doing on-device compute when it comes to AI. Like, there's another incentive that makes people want that. They maybe aren't thinking as deeply about the privacy, even though that is becoming more and more of a conversation around, like, do I want to run local models? But at the same time, when you can run something locally, the questions you ask against it are much, much faster than when you have to go out to the cloud. Your network connection could be flaky. All of those problems can exist. If you can do that in a local model at a very high speed, that changes the game in terms of user experience and privacy. You kind of can Trojan horse the privacy in under the user experience guys.
All right, freaks. You know me. You know I don't take sponsor money from products I wouldn't use myself. So listen up. The Aven Bitcoin Visa card is one of the most interesting things I've seen in the Bitcoin lending space in a long time. Here's the deal. You can get a line of credit up to $1 million backed by your Bitcoin without selling a single sat. No games, no annual fees, no minimum draws, and your Bitcoin is custodied by BitGo, which is one of the most trusted names in digital asset security. Aven never lends it out. There's no rehypothecation. You stay in control. And guess what? You can lock in a fixed rate for up to 10 years. That's 10 times longer than most lenders out there. Or go interest only for up to 5 years. Rates start at 7.99% APR for a product that lets you keep your stack and still access liquidity. It's hard to beat. I mean, the duration in the rates is the best I've seen in the market to date. You also get 2% unlimited cash back every time you use the card. Spend fiat, keep your Bitcoin, the whole game. If you've been stacking for years and you need liquidity without triggering a taxable event, this is worth a serious look. Go to aven.com/Bitcoin. That's AVEN.com/Bitcoin. Check it out. Freaks, look at me. I'm glowing. I've got like an angel's halo going around me. You know why that is I feel good. I feel taken care of. I feel blessed, healthy, happy. And that is because I'm a CrowdHealth member. My family and I have been CrowdHealth members for 5 years now. Literally this month, 5 years ago, we joined CrowdHealth. We've had two babies. We've had multiple health events, and we're never going back to health insurance. CrowdHealth is crowdfunded healthcare. So you sign up for CrowdHealth, you pay a monthly fee, you help out with other people's bills, and it's significantly cheaper than health insurance. We were on Cobra as a family of three when I left my last job before I went full-time to CFTC. Went on the CrowdHealth. Now as a family of five, we pay I believe $700 a month. It's significantly cheaper. They're going to negotiate prices lower for you. They've consistently negotiated healthcare prices as much as 50, 60, 80% in many cases. They help out with babies. If you have a pregnancy, you pay the first $3,000 and the crowd covers the rest. If you have a regular health event, you pay $500 and the crowd pays the rest. Go to joincrowdhealth.com. Sign up today. Use the code TFTC. Opt out of health insurance. I'm uninsured, baby, and I love it. Use the code TFTC at joincrowdhealth.com and you'll get $99 a month for the first 3 months that you're on the CrowdHealth platform in the community. Bitcoiners, you found sovereign money. Now find sovereign health and sovereign healthcare.
Digging into secure enclaves, this is an area I think has been very underexplored. Shout out to the team at Maple AI for bringing sort of private LLMs via secure enclaves, like truly private LLMs compared to something like Venice. I think their design choices are incredibly wise. And I think the leveraging of secure enclaves is an underexplored area. And it's encouraging to see companies like Enclavia from Alexis Fellini come to market and just exploring that design space is something that, again, seems underappreciated to me right now. How would you describe the potential there? And you mentioned eCash earlier. I know Calais is exploring sort of these eCash mints that live in the enclave that are cryptographically provable, that the operator can't really control them to some extent at the end of the day. What are we missing in the market by not leveraging secure enclaves to their full potential right now?
Yeah, they're really interesting. I mean, like, oh, go ahead, Vic. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say specifically for AI, you mean?
For everything, right?
Oh, yeah, I think AI. For everything. Yeah, I mean, Seth and I were kicking the idea around just a few weeks ago about there needs to be more providers. Because obviously, the host your own hardware with the secure enclave is going to be super expensive. So we're kicking around the idea. Maybe that's a business model we should get into. Provide AI service that's in the enclave. But isn't BitTensor doing that? Or they have a version where you can choose to run the AI within some enclave. Yeah,
I'm not sure on BitTensor, but I know NVIDIA's launching the GPUs with the Nitro enclaves in them, so it makes sense that anybody wanted to could put an LLM in there.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's definitely in the future.
Yeah. It's becoming much more normal. Yeah. I was just going to say it's becoming much more normal because like that demand for privacy is not just a personal thing as well. Like the primary driver for privacy at scale with the AI space is enterprises. I mean, if you're a business who are dealing with sensitive internal data all the time, you don't want to be dumping all of that into Claude or to ChatGPT. Like there are huge, huge potential issues with you touching anything like that. If you're dealing with customer data, if you're dealing with like HIPAA specific data, all of these specific use cases for AI at scale, you need those. So it's already been something. I mean, like this is not a new technology. Secure enclaves are quite ancient technology at this point. Your phone has had a secure enclave in it for the last decade plus in the Android and iOS space. And it uses it for a lot of the functionality and the security of the device itself. But I think the real shift now is that because of the way we can actually leverage this, especially on the AI side, like there are definitely other use cases, but I think a lot of times secure enclaves kind of get overblown and people forget about what the downsides and risks are too, where they are very centralized. They're extraordinarily expensive. They're not something that a normal person can host at home or would have access to. And they are very much a trusted system. A single entity has the root keys to actually provision all of those secure enclaves. So obviously you're trusting with an Intel SGX, you're trusting Intel themselves. There've been a lot of breaks in Intel SGX secure enclaves over the years. NVIDIA, you're trusting NVIDIA. Amazon Nitro, you're trusting Amazon. Like all of these services, you are trusting the provider still in some ways, to be honest, and to be secure, to not leak those root keys or accidentally set them to null or something like that. Some of that stuff has happened in the past. But the things that it unlocks are a huge, huge shift. Like you said, Maple has been a kind of a revelation because when I'm thinking about how am I going to be using AI, it's similar to how I think about chats, where like I will self-censor subconsciously or consciously if I know that the thing that I say is going to a third party that I don't know what they're going to do with that data. There are some things like I will not put into Claude because I don't want to trust it with that, or I don't want it to know that about me. I even talking yesterday to somebody who I know doesn't care that much about personal privacy. I was helping with some financial stuff and just giving him some tips around that. And he was like, I want to learn more about all the financial tools that like help me see the details about what I'm doing with my money. I know that all that data is being mined, and he wasn't sure how to go about that. But something like Maple is a fantastic solution for, hey, I can upload my bank statements into this and know that they're not being leaked to a third party or being used to train AI. So it's a lot of the same principles that went into Radar and went into CakeWallet and are core to Bitcoin right now. Is there's a freedom of expression and honestly like a weight being lifted off your shoulders when you know that the thing that you're doing is private and that you're getting to choose who knows about it. Like obviously it's not about being this anonymous super shadowy hacker in the woods. It's about you getting to choose who knows about it. If you and your spouse want to sit down and go through your bank statements and get insight into that and ask questions about it, you should be able to do that in a way that only you and your spouse see that info. If you want to have a conversation with your brothers in a group chat and talk about sensitive stuff about your childhood or something, you should be able to do that without worrying about like, what's Facebook going to think when they read through this about what happened, or like those things need to be able to happen freely. And that only happens in a space that is privacy preserving. So secure enclaves are a huge part of that for the AI side, obviously not necessarily as applicable on the chat side, even though, as I mentioned, that Signal heavily uses Intel SGX secure enclaves for the server infrastructure on the Signal side to provide some of the provable, attestable privacy that's built into the Signal protocol. So it's a big part of that as well.
Hey guys, if I could just interrupt.
Vic, I know you got to hop off here.
Yeah, I got to hop off. Yeah. You guys continue, of course. Thanks for having me on. Really appreciate it. Am I getting broken up?
Thank you for coming, Vic. Thank you for building and launching Radar. Like I said, desperately need a product. Been waiting for a while. As you're describing that, like I saw a tweet yesterday, and it's always, I mean, the Samurai guys, number one, Free Samurai, but like talking to Keon over the years, I think the example of like you have blinds in your house, like that's explicit use of privacy technology as blinds. You don't want people looking in your windows. And I saw somebody tweeting yesterday about envelopes, like mail, like when you mail something to another individual, it's in an envelope that's sealed and meant expressly for that person. These are privacy technologies that are surrounding us every day that people take for granted and don't even recognize as privacy technology. But however, when we get to the digital realm, there's this just sort of assumption that, oh no, like privacy doesn't matter here as much as it does when I'm sending somebody a letter. I don't want the mailman to open the letter and to read my mail. There's actually a federal offense if you're caught stealing somebody's envelopes and opening their mail. And it's just hilarious that we've been conditioned in the digital age to not bring that same mindset to what we're doing in the digital world.
Yeah, I think that's the big part to highlight, is it's more of a conditioning that we've, like, the early internet days were not like this. But quickly it got taken over, and the realization that the data that's available in how people are using the internet is immensely valuable. And so we got conditioned by all of these corporations that were building and abusing our data, building companies around selling our data. We got conditioned to think that there just wasn't a way to achieve privacy, and that this was just how the internet was. Like, if you're doing something online, just assume it's not private and deal with it. And if you want to do something private, just don't do it online. And that conditioning, I think, is the root of the problem, because the building blocks of the internet, there's like cryptography and cypherpunks have been core to a lot of the technology that powers the internet. And yet a lot of it's been abused and misused to make us feel like there is no privacy. But these days, that really is just a feeling. It's just not true in how we can use the internet. And that's been one of the really exciting things, I think, over the past few years, is the technology is actually good enough now that when people are able to break free of that conditioning and they're able to understand, like, wait, Signal just feels like iMessage. There's no difference here. And yet I am getting perfect message level privacy and metadata privacy. And I'm not having to tie my ID to this in any way. It's not tied to a phone number in a way that's revealable to other people. Like, that shift happens. But once it happens, people understand that I can actually just have privacy and not sacrifice too much for it. So a lot of it is just like when people break out of that conditioning and that misunderstanding that everything I do online can't be private, it starts to change the game a lot. And we've seen a huge shift in that. So it's been exciting over the past few years that I feel like the freedom tech has gotten good enough now that as people are waking up, there's actually good, usable, real tools that they can jump into and use today to gain privacy. And it's not nearly as much of a nightmare from a user experience perspective or a pain perspective as it was 10 years ago, 8 years ago, even 5 years ago. I feel like when I was first waking up to the need for privacy and falling down the rabbit hole really hard, it was a lot more painful than it is today. When I recommend what people can use, it's a night and day difference.
Yeah. And like bringing it back to the envelope example, it's like you literally just have a layer of some like epoxy that you lick and you put down, and the assurances of that privacy assurance is like literally like a layer of the glue, and yet people respect it. And it's like, how do we make that similar, but I would argue more hardened and verifiable and robust assurance on the internet via cryptography? Mm-hmm. Like, how do you make that like socially not acceptable, but like socially, like, oh no, like this is a foregone conclusion. This should be the way we do things.
Yeah. I mean, it really is happening. But like you said, like the really fascinating thing about it is like, the idea is we can't have privacy on the internet. The reality is we can have actually better privacy on the internet than we can a lot of times in meat space these days. Like the cryptographic tools that we have are so much more sure and reliable and dependable than an envelope that you just lick and stamp and send to your grandma. Like, that thing theoretically provides privacy, but it's also all being tracked and surveilled and read in between. And we should assume that USPS, et cetera, know what's being sent in every package. Whereas when I send you a message on Radar, both of us know cryptographically in a provable way that no other person has read this in the middle. And if they have, we will both see that someone else has opened this somehow. and we'll understand that something is very broken here. With a letter, it's really easy, and this has been happening for hundreds of years. You can open it and then reseal it and send it on its way, and you have no way to ensure that. Obviously, there's some tricks you can do to try to make it clear that someone has tampered with a package. Sometimes we do that with like hardware wallets in the Bitcoin space. They have tamper evident tape or packaging, but for the most part, you have no idea if someone has read the message in between. Whereas with cryptography, we can actually have provable privacy between people over the internet and really have like the best of both worlds.
Yeah, it's like this is the extent of meat space, like high tech privacy preserving packaging. It's like right here. It's like the what are your thoughts on, because let's bring up Tucker Carlson and Signal and the whole like U.S. government hacked my Signal, Russia, like, and read my messages with the Russian delegates that I was talking to, and I think it's important to dispel the rumors around there, because I think Tucker's done a very poor job of sort of besmirching Signal, when really at the end of the day it was likely something like Pegasus or somebody got access to it before.
Yeah, I mean, obviously there's been a lot of other people who have talked about that as well, but the underlying fact is pwning your device is going to be drastically easier than pwning Signal at this point. And that's the thing. I mean, if you are a very high level journalist, activist, dissident, you should assume that your device is compromised, essentially. That's the sad state of things right now. Obviously, Apple has done a lot to try and prevent what damage that can do. And like there's lockdown mode on iOS, which if you are someone like Tucker Carlson, you better be using all of the most hardcore functionality available to you to protect your device. Because the thing that a lot of people forget is like whatever the state of the security on the device you're using, that's the lowest default state of security of whatever apps you're using on top of that. And that's, I think a lot of that is forgotten, even like in the Bitcoin space, when you're using, like, let's say you're using a fantastic wallet like Sparrow on your desktop, but you're using a Windows desktop and you aren't careful about what you download and you're sharing the device with a few other people. If Sparrow and the password you use for that are good, that's awesome. But if the underlying OS gets hacked, you have serious problems at that point, because they have access to all of the underlying infrastructure. They can change things about what you see on screen. It breaks everything else. So, I mean, the assumption and everything that I have been able to find out about the Tucker Carlson incident is that it seems very likely that his device was pwned. Maybe not even Pegasus or something that was a true zero day, but most likely that. Pretty much just like with a lot of other privacy preserving tech, the other thing that happens is people forget that anyone in a chat can leak what's in that chat. Like if you add someone who's not a trusted individual and they're in a group chat, your privacy obviously doesn't protect you from them, because they're the ones also receiving all of those messages in plain text. Anyone can screenshot messages and take them out. Even if there's protection in the app, there are ways to do screenshots outside of that. Like that side of things, I think, is often forgotten, that this is just one piece of a broader like OPSEC, operational security stack that you need. And you need to be thinking about the device security as well. But yeah, as far as we can tell, like the Signal protocol itself has remained fantastically secure, despite being such a high profile tool that's being used by governments and journalists and dissidents at this point. But it does still come down to how secure can you keep your device at the same time.
Yeah. And how secure can you keep your group chat? That the Department of War found that out the hard way a couple of years ago. Letting is it a journalist they let into the group chat by accident? I forget what it was.
Yeah, they added the wrong journalist. They thought it was someone else. They had like the same first name, but yeah, they added the wrong journalist into the chat. Just let him sit there the whole time. Yeah, you can't fix stupid. Unfortunately, that's always the lowest common denominator.
What are your thoughts on the cozying up of the frontier model providers and the government? The cucking of Fable 5, the offering of a 5% stake in OpenAI from Sam Altman to the Trump administration. How are you viewing this trend that seems to be growing? And it seems like the AI models are becoming an issue of national security in the eyes of the federal government here. And I think it's incredibly worrying that this is the case. I think the fear mongering around Fable 5 was, and just Anthropic's positioning and marketing tactics,
yeah,
specifically are detrimental to human freedom, because AI is probably the strongest double-edged sword we've ever come into contact with as a technology, and it can go in two very different directions.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's been the strongest reminder of why open weight models not only matter, but will be essential. Because it's we're kind of getting into a lot of the similar stuff where, like, when encryption technology became possible, the US absolutely flipped their lid about GPG being something that you could export to other countries and that other people would have the ability to use encryption technology, and what a nightmare that would be for them. Governments are always going to kind of like clutch at pearls and hold on to what they can to protect themselves. And in this case, like, there is an understandable national security risk where the government has always been the worst ones at maintaining security when it comes to cybersecurity. Like, they've never been very good at that. Systems are always out of date and stale. I've done work in cybersecurity for governments. It's interesting when you see behind the veil about how out of date and how behind the times they are and how slow they are to move. And when you talk about these AI models, especially frontier models, not only from the, like, we're normally thinking about the vibe coding perspective, but when you get into the cybersecurity world, the ability this gives to outside entities to either for good or for evil, do penetration testing, to find vulnerabilities, to build novel zero-day tools, it's a whole shift in the paradigm of cybersecurity from the ground up. So I understand their reticence, but it's another reminder that if we're building closed source models behind for-profit companies, we're going to be beholden to whatever jurisdiction they live in, and we're going to be drastically restricted from how useful they can be and how much freedom they can actually provide. But the other really good thing is that it's kind of similar to the Streisand effect, where, like, when they try to clamp down on something, it only makes people want it even more. And that's happening even with, I think it's pushing the development of the open weight models further forward, because as they stall out Anthropic with Fable 5, or as they put in these artificial delays, or they try to stop them from using it, they can't do the same thing to the people building open weight models. They don't have the same control over that. And so we're seeing things like JLM 5.2 that are catching up with what's possible. Maybe not, those aren't like Fable 5 level, but they're Opus level. They're getting there to where they're able to provide the vast majority of what people need. And others are waking up to the idea that, like, hey, we can't build these things in closed environments if we want to be able to distribute them freely. They're kind of relearning the whole idea of open source software, which is fascinating to me, but we're kind of rehashing the same thing that we did 20, 30 years ago with open source, Microsoft versus Linux. And, like, there's so many stuff that's so many things. It's kind of a time is a flat circle, but it's been interesting to see that become more popular and more kind of in vogue to talk about this stuff needing to be open source.
Yeah. I mean, you have, whether it's lip service, we're riding a trend. I don't think it matters. To your point about the Streisand effect, you have the All In podcast guys talking about open weight models and the importance of them, which is a good microphone to have, at least incepting the idea of an open weight model in the minds of their listeners specifically. And I mean, that getting back to, like, the convenience of Signal and the convenience of these tools, the ultimate goal should be to get on a convenience parity with the sort of cucked walled garden, sort of not private at all, technology that exists in the digital world today. Because most people, if outside of the bubbles that we live in the freedom tech corners, our corners of X, the podcasts that we listen to, the vast majority of people probably don't understand how any of this works. Just going back to, like, you just need convenience parity with freedom tech. Because if I were to go, I'm gonna go to the beach later today and talk to people, and if I mentioned the term open weight model, they'd be like, what the hell are you talking about? Like, what is that?
Yeah, people, but it's just like no one knows what the triple ratchet protocol that Signal uses is. Like, I bet you've never thought deeply about the triple ratchet protocol and how important that is. Like, no, that the whole point is we abstract away what these things are and we put them in front of people in a usable manner. Like you mentioned Maple, if you're talking about AI, when you're using Maple, you don't need to understand anything about TEEs or secure enclaves or attestation, or like the whole point is a really good company or a really good team or a really good individual can build something that abstracts away the complexity, but leverages technology for all the benefits you need under the hood. And it's really going to be the same way with AI. Like we're so obsessed, especially when we're in the space heavily right now, like we know all the model names and the effort levels that you need to choose for each and like all these things. This is not going to be the future. It's just like when we're kind of getting into Bitcoin, like we know all these technical terms and all this jargon and slang, but the vast majority of people using Bitcoin, they don't understand it. They don't know what SegWit is. They don't really know what fee rates are. They don't know what sats per VByte is. Like that stuff is just not common because we've been able to build tools that abstract away the vast majority of that and make it very simple for them to use. The same thing's going to happen with the AI side of things as well, where you won't understand that it's an open weight model. You'll just see, oh, I can use one that's really cheap, or I can use one that's really expensive, or I can use this one no matter where I am, but to use this one, I have to provide my ID or something like that. Those are going to be the things that separate it out for people. And honestly, already they're all kind of good enough to meet the needs of the average person. And we're only getting started in terms of open weight models specifically. So a lot of that will be abstracted away, but yeah, right now we're kind of in the weeds of things that no one in the real world is going to understand what that is.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned stablecoin integration on the roadmap for Radar. What else in your mind do you think would be a good feature? Like how far do you guys want to push it?
Yeah. I mean, there's a long ways to go now in terms of features. Obviously we wanted to start with just nailing payments, having that down very smooth, very effortless. So I think we did that. I think the two biggest things moving forward, and obviously there's a lot of other things on our roadmap. Two big things are handling payments in group chats. So not even just like you can send to one other person in a group chat, but things like splitting a bill. When you have a friend group that you meet for lunch every Thursday, like when you end, you should be able to just say, hey, the bill was $83.72. And then each user gets a prompt just to pay their split of it. Things like that. Things like fundraising as well, I think will be really helpful. Like the earthquakes in Venezuela, there's a lot of people who are using like a dozen different fundraising platforms. But all the conversations about that are all happening in another platform, like Signal, like WhatsApp. Imagine being able to have a group where you're posting all of the updates about what help you're providing to people in Venezuela, and you get to just put up a fundraiser that everyone sees on screen whenever they're in that chat. They choose how much they want to donate to. And again, all of that is not going through a third party. That's going directly peer-to-peer between the person who wants to support you and keep up to date with what's happening and your wallet immediately. So those are the, I think, two of the really big things are the group messaging side. There's a lot of value we can bring on, again, making it even more social to do payments. The stablecoins one is really interesting. Like, it's been painful for me to start to understand how useful stablecoins are for people. Like, I hate them. Like, I hate everything that a stablecoin stands for and that it reinforces the legacy fiat system. They're usually censored and able to be shut down at a tap. They're almost always easily surveilled. Like they're in every way, they're the opposite of freedom money. And yet when you actually talk to people who are on the ground in most of the countries who need freedom money, they're not using Bitcoin yet. And that is unfortunate. I think a lot of what I'd like to change with Radar is to start getting them to use Bitcoin. But there's a lot of the world where they just need the stability of stable coins, and we can now do that on Bitcoin at least. So the goal is that people will be able to choose if they want to keep their balance in stable coins or in Bitcoin. It'll be easy at a tap. And then again, because we're building both of these things on Bitcoin rails, you can swap between them in a split second, very, very seamlessly, very low, almost zero fees at the same time. So it's one of those things, like it's painful to enable. It's just like a Cake wallet. Like people are like, why do you have all of these EVM chains in Cake wallet? It's not because we love all of the things that happen on those chains, but it's because like when I go to the Oslo Freedom Forum or I chat with anybody from the HRF, like it or not, most of these journalists and activists and dissidents and freedom fighters and opposition leaders, they're not using Bitcoin right now. I want them to. So I want to pair the stable coins they're already using with Bitcoin in one really seamless experience. But we need to support the stablecoin side at first and then slowly push them more and more into the Bitcoin side of things. But another really cool thing, one last thing I'll mention, because of the way that it works within Spark, if you keep your balance all in Bitcoin, but you want to send to somebody who wants stablecoins, you can do that. And it gets converted on the fly in a split second. Or if you keep your balance in stablecoins, but you are sending me Bitcoin in Radar, it doesn't matter. I don't need to care about the conversion. I don't need to care about asking you for a specific thing. We can do that automatically behind the scenes on the fly so that you can choose what you want and always receive the currency that you want, always pay to the currency that the other person wants in a way that doesn't rely on a trusted third party or a centralized exchange. So that's another really cool side of the actual tech that's underlying this.
Yeah. Stable channels have always been the holy grail of stablecoin like features and with a custodial trade-off that is much more freedom-oriented.
Yeah. They're one of those things that I think is... they're very much a like built by Bitcoiners thing, where they're like a fascinating right. idea, but they're like so over-engineered that I seriously doubt that there'll ever be uptake. Because there's just always this disconnect between what do the real users want and what do us as Bitcoin ideologues want to build? And finding the middle ground there is really hard, because a lot of times we have to be willing to move past our ideology and our view of like what the best for that person is and build something that's closer to what they want. Now, obviously I'm not saying that we give up on self-custody because people just want simple user experiences. Like there are some hard lines that we draw, but that we have to get closer to where they're at. And like everyone's already using USDT, USDC, using them on EVM chains that are very quick. Stable channels have a lot of other downsides and usability issues amongst broader issues about how that will actually work on the Lightning Network. They're really cool in theory, but in practice, like getting a user to actually adopt that when the user just wants stable balance. They don't really care if it's on that, but if it feels just as good and it happens to be on Bitcoin, awesome. If it feels totally different and painful to use, it's just not something that's going to gain uptake. But we'll definitely see. I mean, it's the same with like RGB has been like a thing that's been talked about for feels like a decade now. long time. And it's always like, it's going to solve all these problems and they're going to do stable coins natively on there and Taproot. But it's always kind of like trying to, I think, shoehorn Bitcoin into something where you don't necessarily need Bitcoin. Or trying to do things in a way that's just too hardcore, that's not going to actually meet people where they're at. But it's always a balancing act, because you don't want to give up on all the fundamentals and all the things that really matter just to meet people where they're at and just for mass adoption. And yet you want to try and meet them as closely as you can to where they're at. And it's a hard line to walk.
No, to that point, to the credit of many of the builders in the industry, and I feel like they've been dragged away from the hardcore ideological sort of tool perspective towards the meat in the middle by actors like Lightspark, David Marcus, Lightspark and his team there, and others. And I do think the last 2 years specifically, the sort of ability to look at the trade-off matrix and sort of draw the lines and begin to move toward the line where you're meeting people in the middle has been moving in a positive direction, which is good. I think it'll be good.
Yeah. I think like Spark is a really good example of that, where at first glance, you're like, nah, it's not Bitcoiner enough. Like, I don't think this is the right solution. When you actually dig into it, you realize like, it's a very pragmatic set of trade-offs where it's not, I don't think it goes too far into the custodial or into the trust models being too onerous. And yet it makes some design decisions that just make sense when you talk about how do we bring a reasonably trust minimized solution in a way that people can actually use. And that's been I think a huge wake up call to a lot of people, and should be, of there's room for doing things in the super hardcore way, but there's also room for figuring out like, where can we compromise, for lack of a better word? Like, I know compromise is a scary word for people, but Where can we compromise specific pieces of that without compromising the core of what Bitcoin offers? And Spark is a really good example of that. And I think LightSpark have, like, as much hate as they get, they've found good ways to build out things that people really want on Bitcoin rails. Now, I think it does stay up to us as the more hardcore Bitcoiners, perhaps, to kind of keep them accountable and make sure that they do keep building in ways that are empowering the individual, and we don't lean too far towards custodial or too far towards just like layering on the legacy banking system on top of Bitcoin. But it is interesting to see that there's got to be this balance between ideology, but also pragmatism, and figuring out what will actually work, not just what is the most hardcore route we can take, what will actually work, and how far can we take that towards the Bitcoin that we want to see.
Yeah, we're beginning to see the emergence of the semantics of unilateral exit wars emerge, whether it's via Spark or the competing, competing or complementary, depending on how you look at them, ARC protocols as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like Bitcoiners do themselves a disservice when they get into the semantic wars. It's like, in your mind, what are the trade-offs there?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's always funny to me because, like, in all of these things, there is a clear point that should be made. And I think the point that Spark right now, a wallet built on Spark cannot do unilateral exit in a clean way, even if you can do unilateral exit in Spark via other tooling. That point is good. It should be raised. People need to understand that trade-off. The problem becomes where it's always people with financial incentives who make these claims, and they never quite make them 100% accurately. And so it gets into this thing where it just becomes a war of attrition where everyone's trying to grind down the other side by sharing how bad their thing is instead of just focusing on building their own product. Like, it's something that, like I used to be very, very active on X, like very, very active. I'm not nearly as active anymore because I have something to build. Like, I have only so much time. And if I spend 6 hours a day yapping on Twitter, like I can't actually build something productive. I think a lot of times we get like dragged into this loop of fighting each other and not having enough time left to actually build the tools that we need. I think like BIP110, the whole Knots First Core thing is another example of this, where it's just like the amount of time that we've spent arguing about this over the last 2 years. Like, I don't even want to think about the amount of time and messages that have been posted about this and that have changed literally nothing about the argument. And I think it's very similar to this, like, ARC versus Spark thing, where these should be, yes, competitors, but in the sense of pushing each other to be better, not in the sense of everyone's trying to drag others through the mud. And I think it's kind of like, I think Spark have gone about this the right way. Like, they're not wading into it at all.
Yeah.
They're not getting into the debate with other people. They're just continuing to build. And I think that is the right approach. But again, that being said, like, it's never black or white. We do need to be holding people accountable. And if some system is saying that they can do something and they can't actually do it, we do need to call that out. So like it's always a balancing act. But then like this unilateral exit thing, like technically some of it is true. Like, you can't unilaterally exit in Radar right now. We're using Spark. So if the Spark entity and all the Spark operators disappeared tomorrow, yes, your funds would be locked. Obviously, that's not okay. That's going to be fixed. It's already in progress right now by the Breeze folks to fix it. But if you wanted to unilaterally exit, you can use this separate tool, which you can just import your seed phrase into and exit. So there are ways to do it, but it's not as seamless as it should be. And obviously, that does need to be fixed.
Yeah, but to me, it seems like it's pointing in the right direction. And again, getting into the semantic shit throwing is not productive. To your point, I think that's, I don't wade into those arguments anymore. BIP110, I spent 2 days at Bitcoin Plus, I think last year, 2 years ago, maybe even at this point, talking about the opportune battles between, and like interviewing people on both sides. And I think then I realized, like, doesn't seem like they're going to come together. You're not going to have a productive conversation here. And so there's like, even though many people try to goad me into that conversation, like, it's not worth the effort. Like, I'm never going to convince you. You're never going to convince me. Like, let's just see you on the field. I think more people need the see you on the field mentality. Just go build your thing. And to the sort of competition between Spark and ARC, yes, there is a degree of competition, but they're all interoperable protocols via the Lightning Network. Like, they're all going to find their spot and in use case that people are sort of attracted to and the trade-offs make sense for. And I think there's a big tent where all these things can work together.
Yeah. Yeah. And they're all open protocols, which, again, like we talked about with open source, one of the beautiful parts of this is they have to really aggressively compete for the user, because the, like, even with Arc specifically, like, anyone could spin up an another arcade. Anyone could spin up another Bark if they wanted to. Anyone could spin up another Spark entity as well. So they have to be really aggressive with how they compete. And because the switching cost is essentially nothing. Like, if I use a Spark-backed wallet right now and I decide, oh, I really want to use RK, I just send the sats over Lightning and I'm done. There's no friction. There's no new account. There's nothing like that. And that's one of the really beautiful things about these is there will be really fierce competition because they have to compete for users in a way that there aren't walled gardens. There's no IP laws protecting them. It's all open protocols, open source, and open money. And Lightning making them interoperable really means that we don't need one to win. They all work well together. And that's another thing that's really awesome is, like, I and users don't need to care, like, am I using a Spark wallet? Is it an Arc wallet? Is it a full Lightning wallet? When they actually need to make a payment, they just make a payment and it just works. And then everything else gets settled under the hood. And that's a huge benefit of these things as well, is you pick the wallet that you want and you get a really good Lightning user experience. So that's what's so exciting about Spark and both Arc implementations, is we can actually do Lightning in a way that's really user-friendly now.
Yeah. And, like, who's to say? Like, I'm becoming more convinced that the whole form factor of how we interact with computers is changing. Like, I don't think UIs and all, like we mentioned earlier, like, you can be a projectionist now. Like, if you want a UI, you can have one. But I think the her version of reality that Spike Jones put out there over a decade ago, or maybe two decades now at this point, like, it's coming true. And so, like, I think rethinking just, like, how these things actually work or how people interact with them in the first place is something people need to put a lot of thought into. Like, I can see, like, Bitcoin payments being sent in a way where it's like, hey, Seth just bought me dinner. Can you send him $20 worth of sats? And I just tell my agent, it just does it. And I have no idea what's happening in the background.
Yeah, it's going to be an interesting one. Like, the other interesting thing with that too is, like, your agent could run a full Lightning node and manage liquidity theoretically. So, like, there's some ways where we could start to see a shift back towards the more complex technology under the hood and the more sovereign tech, because you're not having to worry about the actual UI or UX yourself. You're able to say, like, hey, go ahead and create a wallet. Make sure you keep enough inbound liquidity for me to receive $100 a month or $100 a week or day, whatever. And it can figure out how to actually do that under the hood. And you don't have to actually worry about that. And me as a wallet dev, I don't have to worry about that either. So there's some ways too that can, like, AI can be a great tool for self-sovereignty and that it can help you to do technical things you would never be able to do yourself. So even if these less trust minimized tools like Spark and Arc compared to something like running a full-fledged Bitcoin and Lightning node, if those do go away or they start to censor people or whatever, like the agentic future that I guess we're walking into now, could enable you to do all this stuff in a much simpler way. Even if you don't have the technical know-how to do all this self-hosting stuff, it can do it for you. It's something it's actually really good at today.
Yeah. Well, that, I want to be respectful of your time. I know it's a Friday in the summer. Any final thoughts, notes, calls to action as it pertains to Radar? This has been fascinating.
We
need to do a proper, like, 3-hour debrief on privacy tech at some point.
we really do. There's always time for that. I'm always down for the long form stuff about privacy and get into what the freedom tech space is looking like today. When it comes to Radar, I mean, the biggest things are, like, it's been exciting to be able to combine the two most personal things that people do, where the people you talk to and the people you pay, just bring it into one place, make it seamless, make it a really good user experience, do it in a way that's self-custodial, that's privacy preserving, on the messaging side specifically. And that has just been an absolute blast. If you want to give it a try, go to radar.chat. You can learn everything about it, download it there. If you want to migrate from Signal, do a backup first, save that recovery key that it gives you. And then you can just log into Radar you'll import that back up. It'll be super seamless at that point. And view it as something that would replace your primary Signal app. If you're not a Signal user already, then now's the time. You'll become a Signal user when you become a Radar user. Give it a try. Give us a shout out if you run into issues or if you have feedback for us. We're constantly iterating. Already pushed multiple updates this week. So always leaning on customer feedback at the same time. But yeah, radar.chat. Follow us on social media at radarchat. Pretty much on every platform. It's been a ton of fun to build this. Vic's idea from the ground up. It's been fun to be able to build, bring that into reality over the past 6 months or so and build out something that I think could be really, really powerful Freedom Tech moving forward.
Go check it out, freaks. Seth, thank you so much. And Vic, you're not here, but thank you as well. We'll do this again at some point.
For sure. Thanks for having us, Marty.
Peace and love, freaks. Thank you for listening to this episode of TFTC. If you've made it this far, I imagine you got some value out of the episode. If so, please share it far and wide with your friends and family. We're looking to get the word out there. Also, wherever you're listening, whether that's YouTube, Apple, Spotify, make sure you like and subscribe to the show. And if you can leave a rating on the podcasting platforms, that goes a long way. Last but not least, if you want to get these episodes a day early and ad-free, make sure you download the Fountain podcasting app. You can go to fountain.fm to find that. $5 a month gets you every episode a day early, ad-free, helps the show, gives you incredible value. So please consider subscribing via Fountain as well. Thank you for your time, and until next time.